qualities of charismatic people. Secrets of Personal Magnetism with Dr. Tony Alessandra. In these sessions, you'll explore the unique combination of personal qualities and social skills that causes people to like you, that makes them want to work with you, that leads them to trust you and to have faith in your judgments. This is charisma, and nothing can be more beneficial to your personal and professional success. Moreover, as Dr. Alessandra makes clear, charisma can be developed and learned. It's not like height or hair color. It's not just something you're born with. It's a gift you already have, and you just need to unwrap it. Dr. Alessandra has spent years studying why and how some people are viewed as more charismatic than others. He's concluded that the secret to gaining this power lies in understanding yourself, building on your natural talents, and transforming fears and vulnerabilities into real strengths. In the sessions that follow, drawing on examples both famous and obscure, Dr. Alessandra defines and explains the key skills of highly charismatic individuals. And more importantly, he offers practical tools and techniques for developing your own charisma and for achieving all the benefits and advantages that charisma brings. Now, here's Dr. Tony Alessandra.
Some of the most important things in life are easier to spot than they are to define. What are the key ingredients of success? What is love or happiness? Even what makes a great vacation or an enjoyable evening out? Charisma is one of those elusive qualities. So let's begin with some snapshots of charisma in the real world. Suppose you walk into a room and you notice a small group of people having an animated conversation. You're attracted to their energy and you come over to join them. But then something happens. You notice that one fellow has already turned and is now talking to someone else. Now the original group drifts apart, but that one man again quickly becomes the center of yet another high-energy discussion. On and on throughout the evening, you watch this person effortlessly pull others to him like moths to a flame. What is it about this man that attracts others so readily? How, without seeming to try, does he always become the center of attention? Or, at work, suppose that two managers with equal training and experience are put in charge of similar group objectives. But the results differ drastically. One task force flounders and misses a critical deadline. The other quickly meshes as a team and produces a report so stunning that the breadth, depth, and clarity of its ideas has everyone talking. Why does one manager succeed while her colleague fails to connect with his people? Why does one need to check and recheck his subordinates' work constantly while the other manager just points her people in the right direction and they take off? When we consider these two individuals, we quite naturally ask what's the source of their remarkable authority? What are its ingredients? What has so endowed these men and women with personal magnetism? Is it the ability to speak well or to project an exciting, attractive self-image? Actually, it's all of that and much more. It's all contained in the single word, charisma. Because it sometimes seems so hard to nail down a definition, we often presume charisma to be a mysterious trait, something elusive, something difficult to study or learn. But it's not that mysterious. And again, it's not an isolated gift as much as it is a cumulative combination of abilities and attitudes which can be learned and practiced and built upon. Unfortunately, most people are brought up to think charisma is something that only others have, that it's something you either have or you don't. And in either case, there's not much to be done about it. It's just the luck of the draw. But charismatic and successful people aren't just lucky. What the engaging conversationalist and the superbly effective manager have in common is enormous charisma. But this is not an effortless gift from the gods. It's not necessarily something that they're born with or that they were able to express at earlier points in their lives. The personal magnetism displayed by those two people probably took conscious effort to develop. Their success with people most likely came about through experience, insight, and very possibly some trial and error. Now, what does this mean for you? Well, it means that you might not realize it, But those same qualities of charisma, those same tools of personal effectiveness, are within your capability. They're just waiting to be understood and honed and developed. The wonderful thing about using these skills is that they make you powerful without making others less so. This isn't the intimidating influence of potentates or generals or other autocrats. It doesn't come from an official title that's being conferred by some higher authority, nor can it ever be revoked or taken away. Charisma comes from within you, and once you grasp its power, it can never be taken away. But wait a minute. Can a geek become charismatic? Can a dweeb become dashing? The answer is yes, if he or she puts effort and attention in the right areas. Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, is not an imposing physical presence or a marvelous speaker, yet he's clearly a leader, and some would say charismatic. Why? Because he's extremely wealthy? No, he's probably extremely wealthy because he's charismatic. In his case, his glass-marked vision and ideas is filled beyond overflowing, making him an effective leader. When Bill Gates went to Harvard as a mathematics major, he realized fairly soon that he was not cut out for the life of a professor in the rarefied world of higher mathematics. His temperament wasn't suited to it. And it's also possible a few other Harvard undergraduates were just a bit more adept with number theory and differential analysis than Bill. But Bill Gates was better suited to early endeavors, such as creating a computer analysis of traffic patterns in his native Seattle, and then collecting a substantial fee from the city for his services. His charisma derived from his ability to see opportunities as well as to take advantage of them. People want to work with someone who seems able to peek into the future. Not everyone has this uncanny ability that Bill Gates seems to possess in abundance. But after spending much of my professional career studying this subject, I can assure you that you do have the ability to become an extremely charismatic person. More specifically, you have, at least in potential form, 10 keys for actualizing that potential. Here's a quick look at how I see those 10 main components of charisma. These are the glasses you're going to learn to fill up. The first 5 fall under the general heading of what I call your silent messages. These are the foundations that underlie the signals that you send out to others. They're extremely important because for most people, they represent completely unconscious processes. Why does one individual look people right in the eye while another stares at his shoes when he's speaking? Why does one person slump his shoulders while another stands confidently? The reasons are found in these 5 very basic aspects of personality: the emotional, the psychological, the intellectual, and the physical. Because no matter how strong and persuasive a speaker you are, how adept you are at building rapport, how well you listen, or send out silent signals, you've got to embrace the fact that charisma is not an end in itself. It's a means toward an end, toward creating a better life for you and everyone you're in contact with. There's so many statements you say about yourself even before you open your mouth. They're your silent messages, and they include everything from your physical posture to your feelings about your job, your friends, and even your family. Your silent messages are evident in the way you carry yourself, physically, emotionally, and intellectually. Such quiet signals profoundly affect people's initial perception or image of you. Of course, image isn't everything, but it is important. As you know by now, doing well in life doesn't hinge solely on merit or hard work. Image, especially when backed up by strong performance, is a powerful force. And a negative first impression, saying the wrong thing, wearing the wrong clothes, coming across as uncaring or inept, it creates roadblocks that can cut off relationships before they get started. The truth is, we each carry around a bundle of opinions about what we like or don't like in others. If you hear a stranger laughing uproariously at the other end of the room, you'll probably make a quick calculation about that person. Maybe it's positive, maybe it's negative. But you do judge how their behavior fits the situation, even though you don't know them, even though you haven't spoken to them, and may not even know what's being discussed. We're all influenced by images. Researchers in Texas, for example, had a 31-year-old man break the law by crossing the street against a traffic light. When the jaywalker wore a freshly pressed suit and tie, many more people followed his example, to the point of breaking the law, than when he wore torn jeans and a t-shirt. The point is, if a person matches our sense of acceptability, he or she has a head start in influencing us positively. When we meet people we immediately like, we tend to put a positive spin, at least initially, on everything they say or do. Some call this favorable first impression presence. Others liken it to energy or excitement. But it's definitely a key element of charisma. People with charisma are able to maintain an excitement about themselves that starts with a favorable first impression, but usually lasts far beyond. We admire them before we even know much about them. Because they win our admiration so quickly and effortlessly, they possess an enormous advantage in establishing a bond with people. And building that bond, forging those relationships, is what helps give you charisma. In business and in private life, people keep score on other people. You can't help it. It's a way of determining whether to accept or reject another person. Every time you enter a new environment, you're evaluated and given a score on various characteristics that your evaluators consider important. You do the same. You use a system to evaluate and weed out people who you don't consider worth your time or energy. For an example, consider this social encounter. A young man and a young woman in a bar. Their eyes meet. They smile. He gets up and walks toward her. When he's halfway there, she starts to size him up, checking out his clothes, his walk, his physical appearance. Each of these factors wins or loses points. When he speaks to her, the sound of his voice wins or loses points. After a while, how he sounds ceases to be important, but what he says wins or loses points. When he finally asks for a minor commitment, such as, "Can I buy you a drink?" she hits the total button and tallies his score. His score determines whether she replies yes or no. Below a certain score, let's say on a scale from 1 to 10, he gets a 4, the answer is a definite no. Above 7, her answer would be a definite yes. When the score falls into the 5 to 6 range, she's uncertain and needs more information. Facetiously, she might think, "Keep talking. I'm still in the studying phase." Everything counts in the scoring process. For example, how many points can a pen be worth? Maybe only a few, but an important few. With that in mind, this is a good time for some quick and easy self-assessment. This isn't a test or a formal evaluation of any kind, so you won't need to take out a pencil and paper, but this exercise will give you a snapshot of where you are now in dealing with some important feelings and ideas. The exercise is especially valuable for understanding your emotions, which is our topic here in Session 2, and it will be useful as well in all our discussions of charisma over the course of this program. I'm going to make a series of 10 pairs of statements. We'll call the first statement A and the second statement B. When you hear each pair, take just a moment to think about it, and then decide which of the two statements most closely expresses your own feelings, thoughts, and actions. I'll pause between each pair of statements, but not for too long, because your responses should be intuitive and reflexive rather than carefully thought out. Don't feel like you have to come up with the right answer, because there's no right answer. There's only your answer. And don't worry about consistency among your responses. Each pair of statements stands on its own, and your responses aren't mutually exclusive. When we've gone through the 10 pairs, you'll have an opportunity to interpret your answer. You don't have to remember or write down how you responded to all the statements, but do try to form a general impression of whether you're choosing statement A or statement B most of the time. This overall impression is more important than how you respond to any individual item. Here's the first pair of statements. A. I usually have enormous physical energy and feel my regular program of physical fitness enhances what I do. Or B. Though I make efforts at keeping fit, I don't always stick to the program, and so sometimes I feel tired or run down. Now, which applies most to you? Statement A or statement B? Now, we'll do this throughout. Here's pair number two. A, I seldom say anything I regret. B, I sometimes find myself apologizing for things I wish I hadn't said. Pair number three. A, I almost always view a new situation as an exciting challenge. B, I sometimes face new circumstances with thoughts such as, I could never, or I'm terrible at. Here's pair number four. A, I'm able to discuss both my accomplishments and my shortcomings frankly and honestly. B, I may get a bit defensive about criticism, and sometimes I'm also uncomfortable even with compliments. Here's pair number five. A, when I ask someone to do something, I almost always say please and thank you to him or her. B, when I ask someone to do something, I expect him or her to complete the task without much coaxing, just as I would do if I were in his or her shoes. Pair number six. A, I like the give and take of meeting people outside my normal range of experience, so I rarely feel out of place at a party with strangers. B, I often have difficulty carrying on a conversation with people who have different interests from mine, so I'm often uncomfortable with strangers. Here's pair number seven. A, when I speak to someone who may have acted improperly, I tend to ask questions before stating my views. Or B, when I speak to someone who may have acted improperly, I believe in being honest by first stating my view of their behavior. Pair number eight. A, I read at least one newspaper daily, subscribe to a news magazine, and otherwise try to keep abreast of current events. B, my busy schedule precludes my keeping up with the news except on an irregular basis, usually via local TV. Pair number nine. A, people often comment that for my age, I look pretty good, and they often comment on my smile, too. B, people rarely comment on my appearance or smile. And here's the last pair, number 10. A, when others follow my instructions, it's because I help them understand the benefits to them. Or B, when others follow my instructions, it's because I made it clear that they would be evaluated accordingly. Now, as you listen to these statements, did you find yourself matching more often with the A's or the B's? If you sense that your A score is significantly greater than your B score, and if you were truly honest, you have a good foundation for behaving with charisma. The more lopsided your A score, the stronger and more positive your silent message tends to be. If your A score exceeds your B score by, let's say, a 2-to-1 margin, the image glass we referred to in session one is far fuller than most. Conversely, if your number of B choices more or less matches your A's, you should be able to identify some opportunities for improvement. And if your B score is higher than your A score, that's an indication that you can benefit from significant work in the silent messages you're putting out into the world. And you may be surprised by just how many messages this actually includes. Think of it this way. Imagine there's an invisible rainbow of energy surrounding you. The colors of this energy rainbow are the different aspects of who you are. There are five hues in this particular rainbow, some brighter than others. There's your emotional self, your psychological self, your intellectual self, your spiritual self, and your physical self. Together, they comprise the silent message you send out to the world. Now, we'll be talking about each of these as the program continues. In nature, some rainbows display certain colors more strongly than others. It's the same with people. They emit different kinds of energy to differing degrees. But I think we'd all agree that the best rainbows, whether natural or personal, are the ones where you can see as many colors as possible and in as vibrant hues as possible. Toward that end, we'll be focusing not only on who you are and why you are, but also on practical techniques and tactics that you can use to strengthen your energy in the various aspects of your life. In this session, Our topic is the emotional foundation of the many silent messages that define you. We'll begin our discussion in just a moment. One of the most impressive things about Olympic sports, such as gymnastics or figure skating, is that it's not enough to just execute the routines. You've got to make it look easy. You've got to seem like you're enjoying yourself. In a word, you've got to smile, despite the fact that performing in an Olympic competition has got to be one of the most stressful things imaginable. And if you don't look emotionally in tune during those events, you're going to lose, no matter how technically accomplished you may be. But you don't have to be an Olympic athlete to realize the importance of emotional connection in so many areas of our lives. If you go to a fine restaurant, you expect more from the experience than someone just putting a plate of food in front of you. There has to be some sense conveyed that you're important, that the restaurant appreciates your business, that your investment of time and money is reciprocated beyond the mere physical characteristics of the meal. In the same way, if you go to a concert or another live performance, you would expect the experience to be different from just listening to a recording of the same program. And the difference lies in the emotional connection the artist creates with the audience. If that connection is missing, the whole experience is diminished. But if the emotional connection is warm and strong, just being there is extremely gratifying for that reason alone. More opportunities can be lost from failure to connect on an emotional level than you can ever lose by taking a day off. If you experience a chronically negative outlook, it may be a sign to review issues in your job, your personal life, or even your health, and possibly to make some changes. The bottom line is, the emotional messages you send out can make you or break you. These messages can hugely enhance and enrich the way people respond to you, or they can completely undermine everything you're trying to accomplish. The choice is completely up to you. In fact, that's one of the key things to understand about emotional messages. You are in charge, or at least you ought to be. You're not the passive receiver of your feelings. You're the creator of them. You simply must take responsibility for the creation if you really aspire to be a charismatic person. That responsibility begins at the first moment of interaction with another person. In fact, it begins before that moment. It begins when you first open your eyes in the morning, when you first interact with the world, when you first interact with yourself. The great spiritual traditions of the world have one thing in common. They all begin the day with a morning prayer. They all recognize the importance of giving focused attention to the state of our consciousness at the earliest possible moment. Life is not just a matter of physically dragging yourself out of bed, splashing some water on your face. It's a matter of consciously choosing the state of mind you will inhabit during the day. And all this takes place well before you come into contact with anybody else. Colin Powell, the son of Jamaican immigrants, rose from the streets of the Bronx to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and one of the most admired men in America. In his best-selling book, An American Journey, he gives 13 rules that he's come to live by. Many of them embody the basic value of positive emotional outlook. For example, here's one of them. It's not as bad as you think. It will look better in the morning. Here's another. It can be done. Here's a third. Don't let adverse facts stand in the way of a good decision. Don't take counsel of your fears or naysayers. And finally, perpetual optimism is a force multiplier. Optimists like Powell generally believe that power or control comes from within them. They feel that they're ultimately responsible for their own successes. They view most problems as solvable, and they're willing to assume risks that might deter more fearful people. Perhaps the most important lesson for creating positive emotional messages is simply this. There are things in life that we can control, and there are things that we can't control. And as the philosopher Rudolf Steiner put it, we need the strength to change the things we can, the courage to accept the things we can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's a fact of American history that, without exception, the taller of two presidential candidates has always won the election. Studies have also found that men over 6 feet tall tend to be more financially successful than those who are shorter. But so what? I hope you're not going to take this as advice to start taking growth pills. Don't waste time and energy on something that simply can't be changed. As a business person, you can't control the economy. As a friend, you've got to accept the fact that not everyone will behave exactly the way you might want. As a parent, you're going to have to deal with some tears along with the love and laughter. But you can always control the expression on your face and the tone of your voice. You and only you can decide whether you treat people with respect and consideration. Ultimately, those are the things that make the real difference, and they're determined by the degree to which you take command of your emotions. That's not only an important key to developing charisma, it's basic to living a full and rewarding life. We spoke of the rainbow of energy that surrounds each of us and how the qualities of the different colors expresses our particular strengths and our present shortcomings. In a truly charismatic person, all these colors have been raised to maximum intensity. So far, we focused on the emotional component of your rainbow energy, and now we'll look closely at what might be called your psychological self. To some extent, this is a fuzzy concept, because there's a big overlap between the emotional and the psychological. But for our purposes, the emotional is how you feel about yourself and the world, while the psychological is how you think. Do you think of yourself as a positive, proactive person? Do you think of your goals as achievable? Are you locked into a psychological rut that perpetuates the same negative thoughts day after day? Or are you psychologically flexible and open to new opportunities? Thought is a very interesting phenomenon. In some ways, the real nature of thought has remained quite mysterious, like the nature of consciousness itself. But there are also certain facts about our thoughts that are quite clear. And let's begin this discussion of the mental processes of charisma with some of the most important facts of all. First, do you remember when you were a kid and you would do something like make a face or start talking in some goofy accent, and your mom or dad would say, "If you keep that up, your face is going to get stuck that way." Well, whether your parents realized it or not, at the time, they were expressing a very important psychological truth. Once a thought process becomes established in your mind, regardless of the reason it began, you can indeed get stuck with it. The late Earl Nightingale's many books, radio broadcasts, and audio programs helped create our current interest in personal development. He went even further in emphasizing the role of thought in success and fulfillment. Earl Nightingale called this the strangest secret. And after years of study, he refined the secret to just 6 words. You become what you think about. This is not only philosophically true, it's even biologically true. Every thought has a physical manifestation in our bodies. In a very real sense, thoughts are things. Every thought produces physical substances, neurotransmitting enzymes that have instant effects on how we feel and on who we are at the cellular level. So it's really true. Who you are right now is the sum total of what you've thought about up to this moment. And if you're not completely satisfied with who you are right now, the good news is that who you will be from now on is entirely up to you. Change your thoughts, and you can change yourself. Considering the importance of thought in our lives, it's surprising how little most of us know about what really goes on when we think, not only neurologically, but even in terms of what we actually experience. It may seem, for example, as if we're thinking about many things at once, but actually, the human brain is constructed so that it can deal with only one thought at a time. This is an extremely important concept to understand, so I really want to emphasize it. You can only think one thought at a time. That may sound surprising or even untrue, because your thoughts can appear very quickly. So our impression can be that several are occurring at the same time, but they're not. And there's a classic exercise in cognitive psychology that should make this clear. In this exercise, a research subject is given a specific, vivid, and quite arbitrary image and is asked to focus on it for a minute or so. A white elephant is the example that's been used a lot. You can try it yourself. Create an image of a white elephant and hold it very clearly in your mind. That's the first part of the exercise. Now, in the second part, you're asked not to think about that white elephant. You can think about anything else except that very vivid image that you had been concentrating on. Try it yourself right now. Think about whatever you want, but just don't think of a white elephant. Do you see what happens? When you're told not to think of something, this inevitably brings that very thought to mind. And any other thought is excluded because it's been established that the mind can hold only one thought at a time. Science has also learned that during the course of a waking day, we each have upwards of 50,000 separate thoughts. That's a lot to handle during a nearly 16-hour period. Where do all those thoughts come from? How does the mind generate so many separate mental images? Well, it's not as difficult as it may seem, and the reason it isn't brings up a third well-established fact about human thought. The vast majority of our thoughts in a given day aren't new. They're the same things we thought about yesterday and the day before that, or even the year before that. For the most part, our minds are simply following well-worn paths that have been established over time. We're thinking the same things again and again, and unless some very conscious attention is brought to bear on that process, the sum total of your thoughts is going to change very slowly, if at all. So let's sum this up for a moment. Three facts have been very well established about the process of human thought. First, we can only think one thought at a time. Second, we entertain more than 50,000 separate thoughts during the course of a day. And third, most of those thoughts are not new, but are recycled material that appears again and again over the course of our lives. They're thoughts that have become automatic mental reflexes, and they appear independently of our conscious control. Once you understand these three axioms, you can see how terribly limiting and destructive it is if the majority of your thoughts are negative. That's the mental equivalent of a junk food diet that continues year in, year out. If you've built up a repertoire of negative cognitions over the years, they're going to keep reflexively appearing again and again. And because of the way the mind works, you're going to have to get rid of at least one negative thought before you can replace it with a positive one. Moreover, it's not going to happen by itself. Once negative thoughts have become ingrained habits and attitudes, you have to do a highly focused mental spring cleaning to get rid of them. It's like stopping any other bad habit. Ending destructive thoughts takes time and effort and conscious attention, but the results are well worth it. We've spoken about your emotional equilibrium and how you feel about yourself psychologically. In this session, we're going to consider a third source of your silent messages. We'll be discussing your intelligence and how you present your intellectual self to the world. And since we're living in what is often called the age of information, the supreme importance of intelligence should be obvious. It's all well and good to be slim and trim and in good shape physically, but if you want to be a charismatic person today, people want to know about that sponge-like thing that's inside your skull. Since you left school, how much attention have you given to your intellectual self? And please be aware that your intellectual self doesn't mean a high IQ or your ability to win at Trivial Pursuit. I'm referring to the depth and breadth of your knowledge, your mental fitness. Most of us were given plenty of basic intelligence. We alone decide whether we'll use it to capacity or let it get flabby or stiff from disuse. When you read an article in the Wall Street Journal or from a professional journal in your field, can you grasp the basic issues that underlie the facts? If you're talking with someone whose field is completely different from your own, can you understand the nature of their work? And more importantly, are you genuinely interested in understanding it? Can you see an issue from a perspective that's 180 degrees from your own feelings? Can you entertain ideas that come from a different culture or from people you don't like? When your proposal has to clear 7 committees and the CEO, can you express yourself clearly to all those different people? Like charisma, intelligence is a quality that may be easier to recognize than it is to define. And even the most basic definitions of intelligence have radically changed over time. Memory, for example, used to be considered a primary indication of superior intelligence. That was true from Roman times well into the 19th century. And as a result, there were people who performed truly amazing feats of memory. It was not at all unusual for someone to have memorized the entire Bible word for word. Since there was an expectation that an intelligent person would do something like memorize the Bible, people went ahead and did it because they wanted to be considered intelligent. Today, we don't think of memory as a primary attribute of a smart person. It's still admired, but intelligence is now identified with mathematical and scientific ability, and perhaps specifically with computer science. And quickness of mind is very important. If a person is able to quickly find the answer to a difficult problem, he or she will be seen as very intelligent. Speaking with recognized experts is very helpful in understanding practical intelligence. But I've also done a great deal of what may be called field research on this subject. And that's helped me to identify 5 key components of this all-important attribute of charismatic individuals. I did this research and the field interviews with 2 of my co-authors, Phil Wexler and Gary Schaefer, when we were writing a new book called Street Smarts. These 5 qualities may not be validated by the kind of double-blind studies that are written up in academic journals, and if they were, maybe I'd have to ask how practical they really are. The 5 qualities are heightened awareness, confidence, healthy skepticism, risk-taking, and resourcefulness. The first facet of practical intelligence, heightened awareness, has 2 separate but closely related ways of expressing itself. You must be aware of your environment, aware of the subtle behaviors of the people around you, and you must be aware of your own reactions and inclinations. You've got to learn how to follow gut feelings and genuine intuition and not follow irrational fears and ego-driven needs. Highly charismatic individuals are good people watchers. They look for the little signals that reveal what others are thinking or feeling. An especially important key to people watching is eye contact. It may not be a startling revelation, but people's willingness to make eye contact says a lot about how comfortable they are with themselves and with you. As you become an educated observer of what's going on around you, you'll be able to evaluate your gut reactions from a more informed perspective. Charismatic people trust their intuition, and they're seldom wrong, because they know themselves and they know the world around them extremely well. How do you know whether your intuition is right or wrong? Well, if you're often mistaken in your intuitive judgments, it's probably because you're being overly safe and overly protective. It's largely a matter of practice, because there are fears, wishes, negative thoughts, and ego needs that can masquerade as intuition. When your ego is involved, it cancels out the gut. Your intuition will often point out possible problems, but your ego just adds to these problems. A good way to develop your intuition is to start keeping track of your hunches. Write them down and then see what happens. By keeping tabs on which come true and which don't, you will not only see what your track record is, you'll also learn to recognize how true intuition feels. With practice, you'll begin to see how genuinely intuitive feelings carry the most power and conviction. You'll learn to recognize your fears and wishes so that you will not confuse them with your sixth sense. Confidence is an aspect of practical intelligence that has a paradoxical quality. It's easy to be confident when you've achieved success, but in order to achieve success, you need confidence. So what's the answer? Well, I'm definitely in favor of honesty and sincerity under all circumstances, but you may have heard the expression, fake it till you make it? For charismatic individuals, this is a very important phrase, but it has a somewhat different meaning than it does for other people. You see, a charismatic person feels like he or she already made it, no matter where they are in the process. The world just may not know it yet. So while there may sometimes be an element of chutzpah in confident behavior, charismatic people see it as a necessary means to an end. Healthy skepticism is our third quality of practical intelligence, and to some extent, it's the flip side of the aggressive confidence that we just discussed. Charismatic people have a great ability to convince others, but they themselves are usually not easy to convince. They pride themselves on being difficult people to take advantage of. They make a conscious effort to resist believing everything they see and hear. They know that if something seems too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. Charismatic individuals are not cynics by any means, but over the course of their careers, they develop mental categories that help them understand people and their motives. While it's true that these generalizations can create a tendency to be closed-minded and judgmental, they can also save you from being taken advantage of or wasting time and naively entering into every new situation. Used properly, healthy skepticism is really just being observant and reading between the lines of a situation. This applies not only to people with whom you're interacting, but even to the physical environment. This doesn't mean that you have to walk around like you're paranoid, looking here and there for hidden microphones. It's just a matter of focusing your awareness outward instead of inward. Most people inhabit their own world. They're so caught up in their own points of view that they can't see other perspectives, like what other people might think, like the kind of energy that's present in the room, like what's the best response to different scenarios that might develop. An important aspect to charisma is anticipating what people are going to do and think. To do that, you've got to get inside their heads by reading the subtle clues that they give out. If someone has less than savory intentions, you certainly can't wait for them to tell you outright. So you have to watch, consider, prepare for the different eventualities that might arise. Ask yourself, if I do A, how will this person react? Or if I do B, how is he going to respond? In genuinely uncertain situations, charismatic individuals most often give other people the benefit of the doubt. It's not exactly like giving someone enough rope to hang himself. It's a matter of seeing whether people prove their integrity and sincerity when they're given a chance to do so. Jack Welch, the CEO of General Electric, has become a living legend for the way he streamlined the company on a global scale. Welch is a great believer in giving people a chance to stand or fall on the strength of their own ideas. He also wants managers to be personally accountable for success or failure. There aren't a lot of committee decisions and buck passing to spread the potential blame. If a group of employees gets together and proposes an innovation, their supervisor must unilaterally make a yes or no decision within 24 hours and take responsibility for the outcome. In this way, managers are given a level of freedom that's rarely available within multinational corporations. At the same time, they're denied the hiding places that also characterize big organizations. And Jack Welch himself is always carefully watching the outcomes. Some of his managers may have been appointed with a degree of healthy skepticism on Welch's part, but this is typical of a charismatic leader. If things go poorly, his skepticism has been justified in the real world, and he can make the appropriate adjustments. And if things go well, he's enjoyed the experience of reasonable risk-taking. The final element of practical intelligence is resourcefulness. And this may be the most important quality of all. In all areas of life, people tend to find a comfort zone, and they get bogged down in it. This is not conducive to being resourceful, and it certainly isn't very inspiring or charismatic. Resourcefulness is a combination of flexibility and creativity. It's the ability to do things that are out of the ordinary when the situation calls for it. It also means not giving up. A big part of resourcefulness is just persistence. It's important to be creative and look at things from many angles, but sometimes it's simply a matter of persisting until you find the right solution. heightened awareness, confidence, healthy skepticism, risk-taking, resourcefulness. Those are the five essential qualities of practical intelligence. Within those categories, there are many other ways to strengthen your mind. For example, take some classes in a subject you've always wondered about but never studied. At the very least, buy a book on your topic of interest. Commit yourself to learning a new and challenging skill and make it something that's a bit outside of your normal range of experience, such as celestial navigation or gourmet cooking or origami or even winemaking. Join a book group or an investment club where new ideas are shared and different points of view are put into play. Buy a season subscription to a series of plays or musical performances, and make sure it costs a lot of money. By paying so much, you'll feel compelled to attend in order to get what you paid for. But no matter what you do, don't be content with mere information. Seek breadth of knowledge and depth of knowledge. Breadth of knowledge is what enables you to engage in meaningful small talk. And small talk, as O. Henry once said, is akin to putting a few raisins in the tasteless dough of existence. Small talk is the social lubricant that looms large in all human exchanges. Thus, being informed on a wide range of topics outside your area of expertise can be immensely helpful in building social bridges. Then your depth of knowledge becomes most important, because the more you know about your own subject, your own industry, your own occupation, the more power and influence you'll have. In our discussion of the emotional, psychological, and intellectual elements of charisma, we've given a lot of attention to what you say, or more precisely, to the silent messages that are implicit in what you say and how you say it. But charisma involves more than being an accomplished verbal communicator. Does the applicant with the best-looking resume, you know, professionally typeset on the fanciest paper, always get the job? No. It's the person behind the resume, the experience, the accomplishments, the integrity, and the charisma, who should count most. But nevertheless, ask yourself this. What if the resume is badly crinkled or soup-stained, contains obvious misspellings or grammatical errors, or presents the job seeker's credentials in a completely illogical way? Regardless of how stellar the education or brilliant the career, that applicant would never get a call back if he or she couldn't produce a resume that met at least minimal standards of acceptability. So it is with your physical image, the way you look, dress, and carry yourself. It's true that very few people are going to be fooled over the long run by someone who merely has a nice wardrobe, a good sense of grooming, a pleasant smile, and a firm handshake. But failure to attain those qualities could easily undercut all your other skills and virtues. Let's look at some specific ideas on creating a positive impression. The foundation of causing others to think highly of you, of course, is to think highly of yourself, not in an egotistical way, but just with a genuine sense of self-respect. A winning image, therefore, starts with a good self-image. A good self-image doesn't follow success. It actually precedes it, as Robert Shook says in his book, Winning Images. Someone saddled with a poor self-image may do well enough with some people some of the time, but eventually he'll fail, unless he comes to grips with the basic issue of how he really feels about himself. Most of us have at least one or two outfits that make us feel especially good when we're wearing them. We tend to save those for special occasions. But why not try to increase that number to 3, 4, or more such outfits, and thus try to make a particularly good impression every single day? So for best effect, you need to keep looking fresh. Men should consider carrying a portable razor and a small stash of toiletries to ward off the worn-out, end-of-the-tough-day look before a business meeting in the late afternoon or early evening. Similarly, women probably should have cosmetics and hair care items handy, and maybe even an extra pair of earrings or other fashion accessories to give their appearance, and maybe even their spirit, a boost. Also, go first class on professional tools. Don't scrimp on image enhancers like business cards, letterhead, pens, and briefcases. Getting quality stationery and accessories will cost only a few pennies more in the long run, while making you look and feel much more professional. Avoid annoying or distracting habits or mannerisms. Rarely do impressive people cover their mouths or noses, scratch their heads, chew on a pencil, twist rubber bands around their fingers, or tear their napkins into shreds while talking. Marsha Grodd calls these habits charisma robbers and includes among them tugging at clothing, drumming fingers on a table, tapping pencils or clicking pens, doodling, jangling keys or change, biting nails, or cleaning teeth. Not only do these habits make it more difficult for other people to hear you, they also distract from your image as a charismatic and mature individual. Several other tips to keep in mind. In everything you do, remember that attitudes are contagious. So seek winners and spurn losers. Nurture your emotional well-being by choosing friends who genuinely want you to succeed and who encourage you. Also, ask yourself about your surroundings. How's my house or apartment decorated? What about my office? Is it drab or is it energizing? Read some inspirational and motivational books or listen to happy music. Or make it a point to go to funny movies or watch a TV sitcom that makes you laugh. Make a conscious effort toward reducing your exposure to the negative, whether it's gossip from coworkers, violence in the media, or pessimism in your own thoughts. Practice treating everyone, from the janitor on up, as if he or she is the most important person you'll meet that day. This will mean seeking to replace arrogance with empathy. Not an easy task for a lot of people. However, it's a real test of character, and every once in a while, you'll learn a big lesson from that supposedly unimportant person. Give sincere compliments. Sometimes people don't tell themselves or maybe don't fully believe it when they do a good job, so they'll appreciate you mentioning it. Even the most hardened person, despite saying otherwise, does care what others think. "I can live for months on a good compliment," said Mark Twain, who was as accomplished a writer and wit as any man of his day. But words are only the beginning. Don't just say it, do it. Words, while important, are cheap. Credibility is gained by backing up those words with action, especially if you're in a leadership position. You have to be very aware that you set the style both in appearance and integrity. Cultivate a do-as-I-do, not a do-as-I-say philosophy. You can show your sincerity by practicing what you preach on a daily basis. One manager, for instance, demanded his subordinates be pillars of strength when it came to refusing gifts from clients who might then expect special treatment. A day of reckoning came when the manager, known for his insatiable sweet tooth, received a gift of 2 chocolate pies from a local pastry shop. It said there was a tear in his eye and probably a pang in his stomach as he had the pies returned with a gracious note. Everyone in the office had been watching, and he knew it, to see if he would be true to his own credo. Here's another suggestion. Make fitness a lifestyle, not a chore. You don't need an expensive club membership or a cross-country ski machine to maintain a body that exudes vitality. So forget the spandex, the stopwatches, the ankle warmers, and just walk up and down the stairs to your high-rise office or apartment. Or ride a bike to the neighborhood convenience store to pick up that quart of non-fat milk. Skip the cart and get some real exercise while golfing. Take a nature hike instead of watching a nature film on television. You got a friend you meet with regularly to shoot the breeze? Get in your chat while walking around the neighborhood instead of over a cup of coffee or a beer. You'll both be better off. Your health, your appearance, and your ability to interact positively with other people are ever-present ongoing issues. These are not things that you do once a year and then are taken care of, like cleaning out the basement. Every day, charismatic people bring focused attention to how the world sees them and to how they see the world. Learn to see this as an opportunity and a challenge, not as a pain in the neck. When you're stuck in traffic or you're put on hold or you're waiting in a checkout line, see if you can not only survive, but even put a smile on your face. That's what charisma is all about. And maybe, just maybe, that's what life is all about too. We already discussed the importance of silent messages that are at the foundation of your personality and the charismatic power that it brings. Now we'll turn our attention to the external public manifestations of that foundation. And nothing is more external and public. Almost every speaker, actor, musician, and performer at times experiences stage fright, often in the form of sweaty palms, quaking voice, and jelly-like knees. Now, if this happens to you, you'll likely avoid making eye contact or may engage in erratic pacing or rocking. When you do speak, it may be in a monotone voice and with a blank facial expression. Such behavior is a tip that the speaker is overwhelmed with self-consciousness, that he or she has succumbed to what's called butterflies in the stomach. While the fear never goes away entirely, professionals know, as Art Linkletter once said, that you can make the butterflies fly in formation. In other words, you can learn to manage your fear. Sometimes just admitting to yourself that you're feeling anxiety helps relieve it. Remember, though, that the reason you're speaking is because you're the expert. So your first task as a speaker is to find out what your audience needs to know, and then to prepare and deliver your message clearly and powerfully. If I had 8 hours to chop down a tree, Abraham Lincoln said, I'd spend 6 hours sharpening my axe. Now, that's a good point. Winston Churchill's broadcasts to the English people and his speeches in the House of Commons during World War II are legendary. But they weren't necessarily spontaneous. In fact, one of his contemporaries complained, Winston has devoted the best years of his life to preparing his impromptu speeches. Planning a speech involves 6 steps. Let's look at them one by one. First, what's your basic purpose? The first and most critical step in planning your speech is understanding the what and the why of your presentation. It's purpose. Surprisingly, many people overlook this step and end up lost. And if you, the speaker, don't know where you want to go, how can the audience possibly follow you? So what's your purpose for giving this presentation? Is the purpose of your speech to provide an objective that everyone can share, such as, we should work together to improve our corporate image, or we need to approve the new marketing plan? Those are called end issues, ones that already have an end proposed, such as improving the corporate image or adopting the marketing plan. In your talk, you're advocating a particular means to that end. In identifying your purpose, ask yourself this question. What do I want the audience to know or do? And how do you want the audience to feel when you're done? They are inevitably going to have some feelings. Why not encourage emotions that reinforce what you want to promote? Do you want them to feel uplifted, emotionally touched, angry, more appreciative of who you are, raring to go? The more aware you are of the feelings you want to promote, the better able you'll be to choose your words and images to elicit those emotions. The second step, who's your audience? Will they be open to what you have to say, or possibly hostile? To which of their needs should you pay most attention? Are you speaking in the morning, when people's attention level is high, or after dinner, when it's going to be tougher to hold their interest? There's a rule of thumb for how much content versus entertainment value your talk needs, depending on the time of day. Before noon, the balance should be 75% content versus 25% entertainment if you hope to hold the audience's attention. From noon to 6 o'clock, the balance should be about 50-50. And at night, it should be about 25% content, 75% entertainment. So after dinner speeches are the toughest. Try to avoid them unless you're a very humorous or charismatic speaker. When I've been contacted to do a presentation, I have my office send out what I call my PPQ, pre-programmed questionnaire. I ask about the theme and purpose of the meeting, the other speakers who are going to be there, and a description of the audience. It's important to ask about people's titles. You don't want to keep referring to sales reps when they're called account executives, or employees if they're called associates. For example, I found out when I spoke to a restaurant chain that the diners were always called guests, not customers. Third, know your material. If you're not sure what you're going to say, not sure of the facts about the topic, unable to take questions from the audience, then of course you're going to be nervous. And guess what? You should be. Preparation allows your delivery to flow, and it puts your audience at ease. That's because your audience is at ease when you're at ease, and you're at ease when you know your material and know you know it. Fourth, focus on the big idea. Once you know your audience, you're clear about your purpose, and you're committed to thorough preparation, then you're ready to focus on the big idea of your material. This is the power punch, the one thing you want your audience to walk away with. Remember, your big idea must be made relevant to your listeners. So emphasize what's in it for them, how and why they will be better off by knowing this information. You'll need to structure your presentation so it supports your one big idea. Of course, your message will contain more than one idea, but they should all reinforce the primary focus of your big idea and its relevance to the audience. Let me give you an example. Here's a classic big idea. We need to support literacy efforts in our community because these young people are the people who will be working for your companies, answering your calls for service, and voting for your public officials. Do you care if these individuals can't read? Similarly, if I were to summarize the one big idea of this program, here's what it would be. Gaining charisma is not mysterious. You absolutely can learn it. As you outline your presentation, limit yourself to no more than 7 ideas that support your one big idea. As you develop the details and images for your speech, keep checking back to your one big idea and make sure it all relates directly. The fifth step is to get and keep the audience's attention. There's an old saying among speakers, have a powerful, captivating opening and a strong, memorable close, and put the two of them as close together as possible. Grab your listeners with something vitally interesting to them, or give them an exciting, interesting story or an example that leads into your big idea. Try to draw them into the subject by using a strong quotation or even a startling statistic. Be succinct and use simple graphic language. Most of all, never apologize. If the airline lost your bag and you're in yesterday's clothes, or if you're a last-minute substitute for the best speaker in the country, maybe even if you have the flu with 101-degree temperature, don't mention it. Don't apologize for your slides being upside down or for the room being too hot or too cold. Don't apologize. The minute you apologize, your ability to influence the audience goes down. Do everything that you can to make sure that none of those negatives happen. But if they do, go on. As my mentor Bill Gove always used to say, a professional is at his best regardless. I found that whenever I had to take a red eye to get to a speech, and I would tell the meeting planner that I took a red eye, no matter how well I did during my speech, they would always think I didn't do as well as I could have if I had arrived the evening before. Sometimes if I'm sick and I tell the meeting planner ahead of time, it doesn't matter how well I do, they always wonder how much better would he have been if he wasn't sick. Well, I learned my lesson. Now it doesn't matter if I take a red eye, if I'm sick, or any other problems that are happening with me. I never tell them in advance. I do my speech, I get my raves afterwards, and then I tell them that I was sick. And they say, my God, that's unbelievable. So don't apologize. Don't give excuses. Just go out and be a professional. Start your speech with power. Don't let the audience think that this is going to be a less than perfect experience. On the other hand, if an obvious disturbance is distracting everyone, don't ignore it. Suppose there's a ruckus next door, Say something like this to acknowledge it. Sounds as if my speech is a big hit over there, too. As you structure your message, think about the attention cycle of your audience and how you can address that with your pacing. It can be discouraging to look into the audience and see drooping eyelids, slumping bodies, or even yawns. Worse yet is if people are walking out. Now, if this happens, you've obviously lost the audience's attention, but there are ways that you can recapture it. Plan a change of pace every 10 to 15 minutes to liven up your talk and keep the audience's attention riveted. You do that through humor, stories, exercises that require people to move their bodies, even if it's just raising their hands, or seeking requests for a verbal response. You want to keep these change of pace techniques as physical as possible if your speech takes place after lunch or dinner. Bill Gove was a master at structuring his talks to be both flexible and interesting. For each key point in his speech, he had a string of stories or examples, all linked like a strand of pearls. He could seamlessly drop or add these pearls and thus tailor his talk to the audience and to the time frame available. That way, he held the audience's attention and could give a cogent speech of any length. And step number 6, practice and visualize. You know your aim and you know your audience. You've prepared your material and honed the big idea until it's sure to get people's attention. Now you need to practice your delivery. It's important to rehearse out loud and to record yourself on either audio or videotape. That's the fastest way to improve. You'll hear how you sound to others. Practice your speech at least 4 or 5 times, but don't memorize it. If you memorize, you may end up sounding stale because you're concentrating on the words instead of the presentation style or the audience. If possible, rehearse in the actual location because that allows you to explore your physical mobility on stage or in the boardroom or even in the office. You'll also get a sense of the lighting and the sound level, and you can practice with your audiovisual materials. The final part of your preparation involves visualizing yourself making a successful speech, and the secret is to visualize with as much sensory detail as possible. Begin by sitting in a comfortable position and closing your eyes. See the room. See yourself walking to the front of the room and being greeted by a warm round of applause. See the audience and feel them anxiously awaiting your message. Hear yourself begin, strongly and confidently. Watch the alert, interested faces as your audience readily surrenders its attention to you. Notice how they think about your words, laugh at your humor, and nod in agreement with your main points. Go through your entire presentation in your mind's eye. See the audience rise and give you a standing ovation when you finish. Relish your pleasure as people come up to tell you how well you did and how important the message was to them. Bask in your success, then repeat the visualization as often as you can until you truly experience being there and speaking well in your imagination. Finally, number 6, don't dawdle at the finish line of a speech. Good speakers understand that the end is just as important, and maybe even more so, as the beginning of the speech. This is your chance to sum up your best thoughts, words, and images and imprint them indelibly on the audience's collective brain. Don't miss this opportunity by running beyond your time limit or fumbling your final message. Know what you want to say, say it, and then say goodbye. Like right now. Goodbye, and I'll see you in the next session.